Welcome to the Ipsos Politics Talk podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley, and on this week's episode, we're going to be doing something slightly different, introducing our new series of deep dives, where we go underneath the data and the polling data we've been talking about on our Politics Talk episodes to try and understand some of the key issues in a bit more detail as we head to the long run in to the general election, whenever that may be, or dare I say short run in, who knows. To start off, we're joined by Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation, Torsten Bell. Torsten, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
So, Torsten, just to start us off, Rin, let's park the budget for a moment. We've recently had GDP figures that have indicated Britain is in a technical recession. That's the term used. It'd be good to get your thoughts a little bit on what a technical recession is, but also your general thoughts on what those figures showed.
Yeah, I mean, so in economist world, technical recession means that we produced less than we did the 3 months before in two quarters. So in the third quarter of last year and the fourth quarter that the economy actually shrank. Now, so that's all a technical recession means. It doesn't matter whether it shrinks loads or it shrinks a little bit. That gets you into the technical recession territory. Now, at one level, when you know, the data came out showing that the economy shrunk by 0.3% in the last quarter of 2023. People said, oh, well, this is quite small. It's not a recession. You know, it's not a financial crisis kicking off. We're not seeing unemployment going through the roof. And that is obviously all true. So this definitely isn't that kind of nightmare. It's not the early 1980s. It's not the early 1990s. And it's definitely not 2008, 2009. I think the slight danger of talking about technical recessions was two dangers. One is punters listening to that, I think, would reasonably be like, can you stop pretending that things are great? Like, it's not a technical recession. It's like it's a tragedy. What's been happening to my household finances in the last year and a half? So can you stop downplaying it with your technical word? The second one, I think, is that actually, even on the techie side of things amongst economists, there's a danger we underestimate how bad things have been going recently. And that's because when we talk about GDP, we mean the total amount of output being produced in the economy. And yes, that's shrunk slightly over just 6 months. But if we care about GDP per person, per capita, which is really what matters in terms of how well off we all feel, well, that's been shrinking actually for the last 2 years. We've been getting poorer as a country. And that's what we should really care about. And that's partly because what's going on is the population has been growing really fast, and that's propping up the total amount we produce. But that isn't really what the sustainable route to being a richer economy, or indeed richer people, as we'd all like to be, is. So we should focus on GDP per capita. If we do that, then we conclude that actually this economy's had a pretty terrible 2 years rather than a terrible 6 months. That's actually the longest period of shrinking that we've seen on record since the 1950s. So you probably drop the word technical at that point, even though you do recognize this is not we're not going into a recession in the way we were, you know, when banks started going bust in 2008 and 2009. It's much more we've just had a terrible 2 years.
Yes, and I think, you know, Ipsos data shows that in our monthly issues index. Ipsos Issues Index is a survey where, for those that don't know, we ask in people's
What do you mean they don't know? Are some people not paying attention every month? Listeners, if you're not looking at it every month, you're a disgrace. You should be following the Ipsos tracker every month.
Indeed, not my words, the words of Torsten Bell, but also my words too. So if you follow that, that's in people's own words what the key issues are facing the country. And consistently we've seen rising prices and inflation, the cost of living, alongside the macro economy, if you like, as most important to the public. And we'll get into the politics maybe a little bit later, Labour being a lot more trusted on the cost of living specifically. We'll get back to that. So with that context of those GDP figures then, Torsten, looking ahead to the budget, obviously always lots of eyes on the budget anyway, but election year, what do you think the key issues are, other than being, you know, the recession point you've made, what do you think the key issues are that the Chancellor will be grappling with going into that budget?
Well, I think in some ways it's a simpler budget than we sometimes have. I mean, if you went back to the autumn statement in November last year, the last chance the Chancellor had to have a go, we had kind of, you know, hundreds of measures, you know, lots of things trying to deal with, yes, some populist stuff on the tax cut front, but some techie changes to try to boost growth as well. This time it's a bit simpler, which is, it's not that long since that autumn statement. So, you know, we're only a few months on. Yes, the economic forecast will change a bit, but not that much over a few months. So inflation's come in, has fallen faster than we were thinking back in the autumn. That's really good news. But the economy, as we were just discussing, has been shrinking a bit faster than we were thinking back then. And the population's a bit bigger. The net effect of all of that is that in the short term, things look slightly worse, but in the long term, they probably look pretty similar. And the interest rates being lower, which is generally the big picture news since the autumn, is interest rates are a bit lower, particularly in the short term, in terms of market expectations. So that broadly means a bit, not loads, but a bit of good news for the Chancellor on the public finances side. And then that is just basically setting up the one big issue that Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt have set this budget up about, which is how big and of what nature are the tax cuts that they're going to be able to announce. And that's basically where we are heading. And then that will then be a public debate about how much do we focus on just what's got announced today, some tax cuts, and how much should we focus on the big picture context within which they are happening, which is some other tax rises happening both in the past but also after the next election. And then also, you know, how sustainable are these public finances? Is it credible that we can live with the level of public spending currently penciled in? Those things aren't going to be a big part of the budget, beyond some exceptions. Like, you might expect some top-ups for the NHS. You might well expect some small top-ups for local government just to stop all the councils going bust by the time we get to the general election. But the big picture story is a pretty straightforward one, which is slightly improved public finances, some tax cuts, a load of experts like us saying you probably can't afford those tax cuts because you're penciling in totally improbable spending cuts. Whether the public or the political class cares about that, we'll find out on the 6th of March.
Yeah. But we've done some polling with The Economist last year on taxes, a bit of another deep dive. One of the things that's very interesting is that one of the taxes, unsurprisingly, that people consider to be the most unfair is council tax. And it's interesting.
The one that's going up a lot.
The one that's going up. And of course, I mean, I recognize that's obviously not set by the Chancellor, but that, I mean,
That's what's interesting. Well, it basically is set by the Chancellor because government has basically screwed down the grant it's giving to councils and then said, don't worry, we'll let you raise council tax by more than we usually would. I mean, if you look at after this election, we've basically got penciled in 5% council tax rises every year. Like, so look forward to that, people. 5% every year, faster than earnings growth. And the reason that is penciled in is because of central government choices about how we're funding our local government sector. And, you know, the councils are going bust. So, you see it. There was data out this week, just recently, on the number of councils that are going ahead with a near 5% council tax rise, which is the maximum you can do without causing yourself local political problems. They're all doing it. Everybody's putting their council tax up by 5%.
Which you know, speaks to the politics of this, because ultimately, if the Conservatives want to go into this election saying, we are lowering your taxes, and again, let's leave aside where the tax burden is versus where it's been in the past for a moment, if the idea is that in an election year, people are going to suddenly notice that they have more money than they did 6 months ago or something through less tax, obviously your council tax bill going up is going to somewhat/completely mitigate that. So that's going to be something to look out for. One of the things that we get asked a lot about, or I get asked about, is fiscal headroom. And this idea of, you know, how much, I think you alluded to it in your remarks a moment ago, how much space has the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, got for tax cuts? A lot of this is based on sort of fiscal rules and, dare I say, guesstimates, is it?
Well, life based on guesstimates, Kieran. So let's not start being too holier than thou. But yes, look, the big picture is that both main political parties say that their fiscal rule that matters, the one that matters most, is to have public debt as a share of GDP falling, not falling in general. And you may remember that Laura Trott got herself into a bit of hot bother in an interview with Evan Davis about this recently. So, but not falling in general, but falling between years 4 and 5 of the Office for Budget Responsibility, the government's official forecasters' fiscal forecast. So 4 and 5 at the moment means between 27, 28 and 28, 29. Can you just please make sure debt is falling between those 2 years? Now, as you can probably tell from the way I'm describing it, this is obviously a very silly fiscal rule, in the sense that aiming to have debt falling is generally a good rule. saying that your only job is to make sure it's falling between two particular years and it doesn't matter if it goes through the roof in the prior years is obviously not a sensible way to run the public finances, but that is where we are. So when people say headroom, what they mean is, could the Chancellor spend more money in that fifth year, in this case, 28, 29, which announcing permanent tax cuts, which have costs in every year, will involve? Can he spend more money in that year without flipping the debt falling into a debt rising situation? So that's what everyone spends their time talking about in the run-up to a budget. Yes, it's a silly fiscal rule. Yes, talking in those terms is also a bit silly because the big picture should be a rounded view about the sustainability of the public finances. It should be asking whether debt is on a downward trajectory and whether your public services as well as your public finances are remotely sustainable. But that's all me being very worthy, and that's not going to happen. So, you know, in the back in the real world, the Chancellor and the Office of Budget Responsibility are going to focus on that headroom in the last year. And so we can't totally ignore it. It's just when you hear people talking about it, you should know that really, as voters, this is my worthy bit to all of you, as voters, you should be taking a rounded view of, is this a government that takes the management of the public finances seriously? Are they taking the decisions that mean I've got sustainable public finances and sustainable public services, as well as giving us all the tax cuts we would all like? Because, you know, we'd all like lower taxes, given a chance. That's in the end what, you know, that's what your democratic choice is about whenever this turns up. And it's not going to be May, Kieran.
And I've said this, there are people online that are insistent, but it feels to me like December would be a good bet, given that Rishi Sunak's two-year anniversary is in October. You can say, here's what I've done in 2 years. Now give me permission to have four more or whatever. That sort of neatly, in terms of a storytelling exercise, it sort of fits, but that's not...
Although December is a bit end, it's a bit end of days, isn't it? It is a bit like, you know, really, you're dragging us out now? Like, but I mean, I agree. There's not really a good option at this point. The like November is like a Trump disaster. I think coming back into September, calling it and being done by mid-October, but you know, who knows? This is why it's a good idea never to become the Prime Minister, Kieran. Then you never have to decide.
You mentioned public services. So our Ipsos political monitor shows 78% of the public think they've got worse in the last 5 years. And many people would say that's with good cause to say that. One of the things the public are looking for is, particularly with the NHS, but with other public services, for there to be more money, for problems to be fixed. Could a Chancellor just effectively reinterpret these fiscal rules to funnel a lot more money in? Or what's the downside to something like that?
Well, look, Chancellors can choose any fiscal rule they want. And, you know, so clearly if they'd like to borrow more, then they can do that. But, I mean, they don't even need to start fiddling with the fiscal rules. You can change your choices on tax and then you can spend more if you want. So there's always more room for making choices for a Chancellor than any Chancellor taking. You know, any Chancellor taking a decision is always going to say, I've got no choice but to take this decision. But the truth is, whatever the position is, spending more, spending less, taxing more, taxing less, there's always other choices. And you've raised one of them. I think the question, at the moment, the question really isn't, could they spend more than they are now? I mean, at the moment, we've got penciled in some pretty chunky spending cuts happening after the election. So I think the real question, the more interesting question is right now is it plausible those spending cuts could be delivered? We're talking about 17% cuts to unprotected departments in the years after the next general election for day-to-day public service spending. My basic view is, looking at the state of public services, you're not going to take a fifth off the budget of the likes of local government, the police, prisons. I mean, anyone that's looked at the state of our prisons right now, or look at the turnover of our prison staff at present, you're not going to find that easy to deliver. So then the question is, what do you do about that? You could adopt a more loose fiscal position, what you're talking about, or you have to raise taxes, or you get lucky. And lucky in the long term can turn up in the growth space. Lucky in the short term can turn up if the interest rate, because remember, the big pushing up of interest rates in the last few years is one of the reasons. It explains about half of why taxes have gone up since 2019. So if those interest rates go into reverse, probably not all the way back to where they were near zero during the 2010s, but if they went into reverse, then things would also get easier. So you've got some decisions to make, and then you've got to hope you get lucky.
Despite your concern for that idea, imagine you were Chancellor. What other things that you think we need to focus on, specifically in terms of economic growth? Because I mean, lots of people can argue about tax. I think when you talk about economic growth, everybody agrees it's really important. But then if it was as easy as waving a magic wand, that would have been waved a long time ago. So what do you think are the types of steps that can be taken?
Well, like you say, there's lots of small changes that we should definitely be considering. You see those in specific sectors, and you see it on specific taxes. We've got some taxes that are completely mad and are holding back growth. But you're asking me in big picture terms, what's the most important thing, or at least the most important thing that's under our control? Obviously, growth could come because a brilliant technology gets invented that suddenly turbocharges growth around the world. But we can't count on that happening. So the bits that's under our control is investment and investing in our own future. That's true in the public sector, where we have to invest in not only the net zero transition, but the transport that underpins our country working effectively, and the housing that means we can all live without it breaking the bank. So investment's the most important thing. As I say, the public sector, the big picture of what's been going on, I think, is that most political parties now have woken up to the fact that we can't get away with the ludicrously low investment levels that we saw in the 1990s. I mean, the 1990s, we all love Ken Clark now, but he basically moved public sector net investment to zero. Yeah. Remember, the average across the OECD is over three. We did zero. You want to know why the trains were falling apart? Zero investment. And that carried on to a surprising degree during the 2000s. Not big increases in public sector investment. That's why you had PFI and the others, because if you wanted hospitals built and schools built, you used PFI rather than public sector investment to do it. Again, George Osborne then cuts public sector investment again after the 2010 general election. But generally in the last, since about 2018, what you've seen is Conservative chancellors wanting to increase public sector investment, because I think people have at last woken up to the fact that if you don't invest in your future, nobody else will. The problem is Liz Truss, which is that Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak as Chancellor set out plans to increase public investment levels really quite significantly, heading up towards 3% of GDP in 2019. Obviously, this pandemic happened. But really what happened is, after the Liz Truss debacle with the mini-budget in 2022, Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak made the numbers add up again by slashing public sector investment, again by about £15 billion to £20 billion. It's still not low, but it's definitely not as high as it's going to need to be as we traverse the net zero transition. And so that is really, really important to get right. And that's not always easy. That will involve some problems for us in terms of lower consumption levels to fund that investment. And then obviously the private sector needs to invest, but we've got to provide the stability that lets them do that. Jeremy Hunt has moved in the right direction in making the tax system for the private companies more tax to encourage in investment more than it was before. He did that in the autumn statement. That's a very good thing. And then we just generally need to make sure that we are all the time thinking, what does it take to make sure our companies can invest? From a macroeconomic perspective, I would also say if we succeed in all of that, it probably requires us all to save more as individuals, because it's easy for people to say, oh, we'd like more investment. But in the end, higher investment levels can only be funded by borrowing from abroad, which we do lots of already, or from more saving at home. And we probably also need to be doing more of that saving.
So let's finish briefly on Labour. So there's been a lot of talk about what does Labour stand for? What's the vision? And that certainly comes through in our data. There's been, at times we've seen as many as half of the public tell us that they're not clear what Keir Starmer stands for, let's say. And when you look at Labour's fitness to govern over the last 10 years, it's pretty consistent over time. Whereas actually what's happened is the faith in the Conservatives has collapsed since 2019. So there is some evidence in the data that Labour's poll leaders as much to do with government weakness as Labour's strength. And maybe it's always thus when it comes to...
I was going to say, do we remember 1997 or 2010? I mean,
well, exactly.
government having a bad time does tend to lead to oppositions getting elected.
Exactly. And I think, like, we don't want to over... I always say in presentations, you don't want to sort of try and create a cliffhanger out of a 20-point lead. That being said, there are going to be more eyes on Labour, particularly around this budget and going into the general election, for obvious reasons. So it feels to me there's a bit of a fine line Labour are trying to walk between showing they can be change, but then obviously reassuring people that they can be trusted on the economy. And just briefly on the issues themselves, if you ask about which party you trust most on the NHS or the cost of living, Labour can have leads over the Conservatives of 20 points or more. When you ask which party do you trust on managing the economy, we still find it's neck and neck. So
Remember, Labour were behind in 1997 on that measure.
Yeah.
So, like, Labour's always basically behind.
Unless they're in government.
Unless they're in government. And being in government does tend to make people keener on you.
How does Labour traverse that line, I guess, in their response to this budget and going into the election? Because clearly Rachel Reeves will talk a lot about fiscal rules, but also there's a lot of concern about public services and the cost of living and so on. So it's a big challenge, isn't it?
It is a big challenge. I mean, one thing I think it's important for us to think about is that the challenge isn't really a challenge to Rachel Reeves or the Labour Party, or indeed to Rishi Sunak or to Jeremy Hunt specifically. It's a challenge for the country, which is that we're struggling to add up our wish for taxes that have already gone up a lot, not to go up any higher, with the reality, which is our public services are crumbling and we need higher investment levels and we can't get the economy growing. And it's that's the challenge. And yes, it's manifesting as a political challenge for Rachel Reeves because the Conservative Party want an election dividing line on we'll cut your taxes, Labour won't. And so she faces short-term questions at the budget, which is, would you match these tax cuts? That the Chancellor announces, to which she's just going to say yes, unless they're completely unhinged. Unless it's for something very silly like inheritance tax cuts, she's basically just going to say, yeah, we'll vote for that, even if it does cause fiscal problems after the next election. As we head from there towards the election, then it becomes, as you were saying, Kieran, it's more about what is the Labour offer? What are you actually getting? And at one level, there'll be lots of angsting in this space, but I think the answer is pretty straightforward, which is what you're getting is green social democracy. It's basically a pretty standard social democratic argument. We'd like to grow the economy a bit. You can trust us to be a bit nicer to public services. With what's changed, and this hasn't just changed in Britain, you see this happening in right across the advanced world, particularly in Europe, which is social democrat parties are becoming green social democrat parties as the net zero transition and wider environmental issues go up the agenda. That's why you're squeezing out green parties in most countries relative to other positions, particularly if you've got first-past-the-post electoral systems. And that's a big change. I mean, even if you went back to 2010, yes, the Labour government's talking about the climate change risk, but it wasn't a major part of the Labour offer, definitely wasn't during the 2000s. For this Labour government, the big difference, apart from it being a more difficult environment to govern in, is going to be that the green issues are a large part of what Labour's offer is.
Well, I guess final question going into that election for Labour, what do you see the biggest risks for them? I mean, at the moment 15, 20 points ahead, looks like a Labour majority coming. I mean, with all the usual caveats people like me would put in place about that you don't know until you know, what do you see the biggest risks are for Labour heading into that campaign?
Well, I think that it's quite hard at this point for the big picture, basically the level of political agency on either the Conservatives or Labour to massively change the narrative or the background to this election is quite low. So basically the answer is, the risk is that the world changes it in some way. Now, you would expect to see wages picking up over the course of this year. They're already recovering. I think that those kind of changes, those kind of small incremental economic changes, I think are unlikely to make a big difference to the political narrative. So we're really talking big geopolitics, big world events rather than big small changes to the UK economy here and there or any individual policies that individual parties announce. So, that might sound like it's unlikely. All I would say is, and this maybe is that, in support of those within the Labour Party cautioning about people counting their chickens or measuring the curtains or whatever phrase you prefer, which is stuff can happen. I mean, the last 2 years have taught us, after 2019 through to 2022, 23, people saying, there's no way Labour can turn around the degree of loss they had in 2019. It'd be completely unprecedented. And even then I was saying to people, just like, look at the volatility. Look how unattached individual voters are to individual political parties. Look how pissed off they are about the entire world they find themselves living in. Just volatility is the defining feature. Now the big picture vibes of the election, as you were saying earlier, do look set, but let's wait and see what the world delivers over the course of the next 9 months.
And of course that volatility carries on into the next parliament, even if Labour was to win.
Yeah, because they probably don't want to win just once. That's exactly right.
They don't want to win just once. Anyway, Torsten Bell, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kieran.